Raising Playful Tots, show number 102. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Raising Playful Tots. I'm glad you could stop by today. My name is Melissa. Welcome to the Play Space. It's here that we focus on play that we want to see and experience in our homes. We cover play-related topics to inspire us, teach us, challenge us, and lead us to have a great time with these kids. And to introduce a new play idea. If you're new to the show, welcome. And hi to the regular playmates that come each week to have a little listen and a chat. Plenty of room in the corner here as we have fun with magnet letters and a cookie tray, thanks to Vicky of messforless.net. Well, hello, playmates. Is anyone else super busy with end-of-term things? It's pretty full-on here in our household. It was a little tricky this week, actually. We had two events on the same day at almost the same time. Two different children, two different places. Ah, hate it when that type of thing happens. The little one had a fabulous farm trip with his nursery that we all were invited to come along. We had to ferry them back and forth. And the middle one had his sports event, and the weather was brilliant for it too. But they overlapped. So trying to choose which one to go to was a little tricky. And making decisions like that really bother me sometimes. But, you know, you have to decide which one you're going to go to. And with three kids, this is just going to come up. So the little one seemed to be okay with going to the sports day event, and we got some good playing in. Also, getting back into the swing of things, I just got back from Brit Mums Live, which is a UK blogging conference. I was on a panel there talking about how we use Pinterest. I know you've heard me talk about Pinterest before here on the show, about finding play activities and things to do with it. And I was super excited to be invited to talk more about it. We even did a Google Hangout about Pinterest, so you can get even more tips if that's something that you're interested in, or maybe something that you want to learn a little bit more about. It was just a really lovely weekend experience meeting people that I virtually hang out with and actually getting to talk with them and learn from each other. You can find out more about that and more stuff by visiting, obviously, the site, raisingplayfultots.com. So I'm easing back into family life. Last week's show was a question and answer session, answering your questions about play. So if you missed that one, pop on over to the blog where you can listen to that show and find the archive of all the shows at www.raisingplayfultots.com/shows. This week's show, I have an interview with Sally Hui, where we talk about storytelling. You know, we read a book, read a book, read a book. We read the same book, read a book, read a book, read a book. Storytelling is so much more than that. And it's that read a book is quite standard practice in our homes. But as a kindergarten teacher, Sally finds lots of ways to revisit the same thing. So it's fun, it's different, and it's memorable for her students. So stay tuned and hear her wisdom, and we can apply lots of these activities ourselves to our children at home. So I hope you'll stick around. If you enjoy the show, this show, or any of the previous shows, please consider sharing the show with your friends or leaving a review for us on iTunes. Thanks. I'll be right back after this break with the interview.
Look at all the cars. Lots of colored cars. Ah, there's a blue one. Isn't it pretty? Ooh, look how fast that red one's going. It's red like that stop sign. Like my jacket.
This is a 38-year-old man.
My jacket's not a car, is it? Is my jacket a car? My jacket is red, but it doesn't go fast.
He may sound a little strange to you and me.
Vroom. Vroom, vroom.
But to his 2-year-old son, who's interested in cars and colors, he makes perfect sense.
That's the sound cars make.
When you talk with your child, you build vocabulary, and learning starts long before school does. So follow their lead. Take simple everyday moments, like eating dinner or just watching cars go by, and turn them into learning moments.
Ooh, look, red car!
Yes! And it's moving awfully fast.
Blue car!
Yes, the man in the red car is about to meet the man in the blue car. Get himself a pretty pink ticket.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. For more tips, go to bornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Today I'm talking to Sally Hui, an early childhood educator and founder of fairydustteaching.blogspot.com. And today we're talking about storytelling. Welcome to the show, Sally.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
We're encouraged to spend lots of time reading stories to children. You love to use fairy tales. What are some of the reasons you would encourage us to use fairy tales as a book choice as parents?
Well, fairy tales have so much power in them, and that's one of the things I absolutely love about fairy tales. And several of the things I want to point out is that fairy tales have this magic number in them, the ones for younger children, the magic of number three. So if you think about it, like the three bears, there's three bears. Goldilocks goes to three different places. There's three things there, the three billy goats. This pattern is what the brain seeks. It's pattern seeking. So for children, when you tell the fairy tales, it immediately goes to a place that they can hold it and own it. And that's what I love, is when a child can own a story to the bones. The other thing is that fairy tales hold a character story in it. Like, it holds a moral. There's something good deep inside of it that gets cracked open for children. And that includes, like, if you look at, again, the three bears, you know, Goldilocks breaks a huge cultural rule. I mean, I don't know any culture that says you may break into someone's home and take their things and use them. You know, it just doesn't happen. Yeah. And so immediately the children connect to the problem of the story. You know, you have this great beginning of this family having this great meal, and then they go for a walk, and then here comes Goldie, you know, and she's just like, no respect. So there's this deep, deep goodness and clear wrong inside the fairy tales that I think speaks to the soul. You know, three billy goats gruff. There's this troll bullying them, saying, I own this, you know. No, you don't, you know. So there's like a clear wrong and then the resolution. And I think that speaks to the deepest part of children, something they really need. So I think it's soul food.
It's really interesting. I hadn't thought about the threes at all, but now thinking about it, then that's often what happens in these stories.
Yeah, if you even, like, for some of the older ones, like Jack and the Beanstalks, you know, Jack climbs up the stalk for how many objects? You know, yes. The harp, the hen, and the bag of gold. There is something very, very profound about that, I think, when you start looking at it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. When we're choosing a story for our children, we are, as adults, likely to see the picture first, and that attracts us to the book. Mm-hmm. But considering we are going to be reading these stories very frequently, how else can we determine a good read pretty quickly when we're choosing new books for our children?
Well, I can only speak to the young child since that's my world. But when I look at a story, and I also work as a teaching artist at a museum, and I read stories to children in the museum, I'm always looking for stories that are not too much. Like, you know, the simpler and straightforward, the better. And there is that predictable pattern. Because what happens when a child can... and I'll give you an example, like Know David, which is a very famous book. Right.
That is Shannon,
very,
yes.
Right, very clear. You know, children can get it. They know what's coming. When I read that to children, they always read with me. They're saying it with me. And then pretty soon we're all saying it in unison, and the room filled with this joy of, Know David. You know, so it has the simplicity to it that then they can take ownership. And then what I think is so critical for literacy is that child picks up the book and they read it to themselves. And of course it's pretend reading, but that's such an important stage, as where we get too much type, too much of the story, and they can't take that ownership. the other thing is, I think the element of surprise, you know, even like in No David, you know, there's this scene where he's going down the street and, you know, his high end is showing, and that's like, you know, all the children, yes, always like, he doesn't have his pants on, you know, yes, there's this shock. There's another book called, what is it called? Press Here, I think it's called. Okay. And, you know, the dots move all around the page. And the first time I read that to the children, I could not believe the glee because of the interaction it called forth, you know. So I think that's something to really look at, the simplicity, the repetition, how much it hits that emotional chord that they can relate to it, you know. Yeah.
They're really good suggestions. You have an approach to storytelling that's quite unique, and you use hands-on literacy 101. Can you explain that a little bit further?
Yeah. One of the things I really see is that taking a story, number one, and telling it orally, you know, telling the story without a book is critical for children. And on several levels, one, it builds comprehension because they're having to use what I, you know, would say is brain smarts, the frontal lobes, to really build that story inside their own minds, sequentially, visually, with all of their senses inside their own head. They get the story. When that happens, it's just profound. So one of the things I always say is I start with telling the story orally. My father, when I was a little girl, would always tell me stories that he would spin. And those are the stories that still live with me when we spin stories for children. So I start with the fairy tale orally. Then I move to the books. And hands-on is when I hit the point where they really have the story. I love to create in the classroom their capacity to recreate the story, whether it be in housekeeping, with dress-up clothes, with puppets. And an interesting thing happens is that when I go through the process of telling the story orally, then bringing the books in, and of course there's all different, like if I brought the Three Bears, there's all these different Three Bear books, you know, there's no lack of them. That there is rarely a child who cannot retell that story profoundly. And it's magic. You know, so, you know, I give them all of these stories and then they're begging to tell it. I literally will have the children act out the story. I'll set up a little stage and say, act it out. I don't have to prompt them. They just do it. You know, and to me that's, you know, having something live inside of them. It's not dead. It's alive within their own being. And to me, that's what education should do, is bring children alive.
Well, it does sound really exciting because they really pick up your tone of voice and the excitement. You can see when a storyteller really catches someone when they haven't got a book in front of them and the children are almost leaning forward and hanging on their every word. And then when you actually listen back to when they're retelling the story, they perfectly imitate and try and do the voices and everything. It's brilliant. It's so good when you can see your children doing something like that. What would you encourage parents that feel a bit foolish doing things like that with their own children, retelling the story and really getting into it? How would you encourage them to do that?
Well, you know, one of the things with young children is they're so forgiving, because I sing to the children all the time, and I literally, you know, my own children who are now grown say, you know, please don't ever sing in front of us, you know, because I can't carry a tune, you know, but the young child is like captivated by it. So they literally don't care about how you sound, how you look. They get transported into what you're creating immediately. And so, you know, I would urge you to, number one, tell stories of your own childhood. My own children loved hearing me tell about when I was a little girl. And of course, I would tell adventures that really didn't exist, but they loved it. You know, taking like that I went on picnics with my grandmother and I would add details of little squirrels coming up and, you know, eating nuts. Well, they didn't really do that, but that added something to it, right?
Yes.
And I would also say that, you know, that storytelling by the parents, I can't imagine anything more enriching for building a child's capacity to read. I think it goes so deep you can't imagine. If you look at history and the tradition of storytelling, I think it's something that's missing in our society, our cultures, our world, is the art of storytelling. I think it is the richest literacy act that you can do for your child is oral storytelling.
I think it's interesting around 2, 3 when they get that why question that they ask everything with a why. It's almost like they want to hear a story because everything you say to them ends in why. So you have to keep telling them and explaining. It's like they're programmed to want to hear stories.
And well, you know, and I worked with 3-year-olds with Head Start, and I remember we would have family, you know, style meals together. We'd sit around the table for each meal that we ate, and I would always tell them the story of what I saw in my yard coming to work that day, and they would expect it. I'd say, you know, the leaves were fluttering on the tree, and I saw a little, you know, bird who landed on the limb, and I just recounted what I saw, and that was so fulfilling for them, you know. Just something as simple as what I saw. I was walking by and there was an old man and he was raking in his yard. You know, they would be just captivated.
Yes.
You know.
That's really good because you give them a model really of what to say and how to do that for themselves. It gives them really clear guidelines. Even though they're so young, you wonder how much they're actually learning, but they really do internalize these things once they're hearing it, right?
Oh, they do. They really do. And then they begin to, but I noticed even I served children who, many of whom were homeless, and what I noticed is they began to take on that ability to communicate, and they began to observe the environment. And we actually ended up doing a whole unit on insects because when we were on the playground, they would start, you know, showing me all the different insects that they were finding on the playground. They were observing like I did coming into work. So,
oh,
you know, it definitely moved into the curriculum.
That's great. Again,
we know that a child's ability to communicate is central to learning.
Yes.
It's key.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's brilliant because you're kind of linking it all together, which makes me think of story stones. When I was visiting your blog the other day, I saw that you had some amazing story stones there. So could you explain what a story stone is and how they work?
Yeah, story stones are made out of river rocks, just simple, flat, smooth rocks. And what we do is we put the images of the main characters and the objects in the fairy tale on the stones. And so then I will lay those out for the children, and they use them to, one, retell the story, two, to create their own stories. And what you'll find is as you use the fairy tales, they will do what we say in education, piggyback, meaning they'll use the same structure but bring in new qualities to the story or new characters. And so they do that. So they just actually move the stones telling the story. I've had children take them into blocks, take them into housekeeping. It's really an open-ended way of bringing the story into their hands. I always say it's to giving them the story in their hands, and then they get to be creative with it.
That's really good. So then do you have more than one story? I don't know how to explain it. Do you have more than one story assembly of characters? Or
do you
keep, say, like if you had the Billy Goat's Gruff, would you have that there with the three bears? Or does it matter which characters that you have out?
I personally, as an educator, I keep them separated out. But I think as a parent, I would give them the freedom of mixing them. You know, I think that would be divine.
Yes.
To see what came out of that. You know, that would be, it would be a little bit chaotic and, you know, with 23 children, but with a few children, it could be amazing. Yeah, I would definitely see what happened.
And so that's quite an easy way of changing the story yet again. So now we can create a story stone, and so we can go and buy these stones or swipe them from our own back garden if we have some that are there.
Exactly.
And you can just paint them or add, you know, a quick picture, clip art, picture that you've got, something, and then tape it, glue it, modge podge it onto the story stone. And then you can also take them off and you know, interchange them, I guess, if you don't have very many stones as well.
Yes, and there is an artist who creates story stones that I have linked on my blog who creates gorgeous, you know, general story stones that would be, I just love. You know, she uses material and really takes exquisite time in creating them, and I would highly recommend checking her out.
Oh,
for beautiful stones.
I'll find that link and I'll link to that in the show notes so that we can go and have a good old nosy over there at her stones,
yeah.
Because it's always good to see really lovely stones and what they look like. For preschoolers and older, you've had a lot of success with storytelling pathways. That was a really interesting way of retelling the story. Could you share how that worked?
Yeah, that idea actually came out of a storytelling workshop I went to for myself to learn how to tell stories. And the instructor had us walk and move as we learned the story, as we memorized it, so that we would actually walk in a specific way so that it actually worked to lodge it in your bones, so to speak, lodge it into the brain in a pattern. And I thought, you know, this would be good for children. How could I take this methodology and translate it for children? So I actually rolled out bulletin board paper, drew a winding path, and then on either side of that path drew the main pictures of the story. I actually now will have the children draw those pictures with me, but then they start at the top of the pathway, and they look side to side and retell the story just off of the image. And it worked so well, especially with the children who, in the beginning, have a problem recalling. It's that clue, that visual clue, and they just love walking down that pathway. And like I said, I've used it with four-year-olds, I've used it with five-year-olds, and it's beautiful. I let them color it as well, let them decorate it.
That must be really good for active children as well that want to move, that they can actually move along as they're telling the story, and that memorization happens because of the motor, the action of them doing it as well. That must be, I can just imagine my very active boys liking that.
Yeah, and that whole kinesthetic sense. You know, there's a book called Smart Moves that I love that really addresses how important movement is in learning. You know, it's crucial. And that's one of the reasons I love arts integration in learning, is that it makes it active.
Yes.
I think we're missing the boat if we're not having children up and into the learning.
I think with the storytelling pathway, certainly at home, if you had chalk and you were outside, it would be very easy to do that on the pathway, make a nice winding path and draw a quick picture on there for the kids to be able to retell the story that you've been doing all week at home with your children.
Love that.
I think that would be a really nice thing to do if you didn't have the big paper that the big
book,
you know,
that.
Paper
yes.
that you could do. Story, that would be a nice
wonderful.
One.
I love that. You know, that is a really great idea. That is brilliant. Yes.
Let's look at some story tales in general, because there's a few new story tales that come up that are becoming traditional story tales now. I think the Gruffalo has passed into that traditional story tale. Could you give us some suggestions for different age groups? Because it can be tricky sometimes with the powerful concepts of evil and good versus evil, that, you know, we can get parents worried about appropriate stories to tell their children. So if you could just take a moment or two to go through the age groups and tell us a few stories that might help us along.
Sure. With three-year-olds, it really is important not to go into those more complicated stories. Three-year-olds absolutely love stories about their daily lives. You know, they're really concrete, things that are around them, things that they are currently exploring. So I love telling stories, like I said, about going to work, what I saw in my yard, about how I cooked my food. You know, very simple, and they're just captivated by it. And little stories about birds and squirrels and bunnies, things like that. You know, simple, short, they love it. when you get older threes and into four-year-olds, the stories that really work well are simple, sequential stories. And that kind of thing really is the age where the gingerbread man and the giant turnip are deeply enjoyed by the children. When the children get a little older, like kindergarten, they're not as captivating or satisfying to them. But those sequential, like, you know, all these people pulling on that turnip, you know,
yes. They
absolutely love seeing it, and they all fly and fall down. You know, even the Billy Goat's Bluff I did with older threes, again, in the Head Start setting, because there is something about dealing with one's feeling of that there's people pushing me around or, you know, telling me what to do. So that kind of addresses that. So I think, you know, late three-year-olds, four-year-olds, they love repetition, things that are said over and over and over again. And so I think that's important. From four to five, you can start getting into a little bit more of that drama, but not the deep evil. You know, they're not ready for it. I really don't think that until they're six or older that you should start getting into, like, Rapunzel or Cinderella. It's too much.
Yes.
4 and 5 year olds love, like, you know, Little Red Hen, Stone Soup, Three Little Pigs. You know, it has a bit of the, you know, parents I know are concerned about, you know, that the wolf eats the pig. But, you know, you say it without emotion. It's a very matter of a fact. And children don't get disturbed by it. You know, when we emotionalize it, they get disturbed by it. But as long as the telling is not too dramatic, you know,
yes. Too
graphic, they're fine. You know, it's just a part of a deeper archetype. And that's what the fairy tales also bring us, that deeper archetype. 5 year olds, I will tell you, I have not gone into the Little Red Riding Hood, but I do go to Jack and the Beanstalk with the Giant. I don't go there until the last part of the kindergarten year, because even 6 year olds are not quite ready for, you know, like the image of the grandmother being gone and the wolf laying in the bed. It's just
yes. A
little bit much. And the other thing I would say, it depends child to child.
Yes.
You know, a super sensitive child, when I have a class of children and I have a super sensitive child, I'm very thoughtful about which stories I bring and what they can digest. You know, because just like TV shows and the images we expose them to, these images live in them, and we want them to be able to process it and not be scared by it. So on top of that, I would say the biggest thing is when you tell the story, not to be too emotional about it, you know, to really tell the story as a matter of fact and let them, you know, digest it.
Right. You have an interesting style where you tell a story in so many different ways. And I'm just excited, really, to know that you're a public school teacher in the public school system, and you're using these principles that you've learned from other places, and you've managed to adapt your curriculum to incorporate the usual things, you know, all the standards and the expectations of the school district, and still yet you've managed to do these types of lessons that are fun and innovative and inspirational and deep. As you've said, you don't, you know, gloss over all the things that need to be done really quickly. You go in quite a big depth with them. You've put it all together in a course called A Dash of Wonder. Why did you write this type of e-course?
Well, one of the things I felt very strongly about is that I know in the United States, the educational system really is under siege. We have legislation and legislators making decisions for the public school teachers that are not in the best decision for the children. And I felt such a commitment not to feel victimized by this or bullied by it. I wanted to truly fulfill what I'm hired for. I'm hired to fulfill the state standards but to do it in a way that I know serves the children in the highest way possible, that I can be the most effective teacher. And when I teach, I'm teaching for, you know, just like when I parent, I'm not parenting for the immediate moment. I'm parenting a human being who's going to grow up to be a citizen, you know, and a of our world, you know, that I want to prepare them for the future. So everything I do is unto all these years. I'm not just doing it for the immediate effect. I'm building a human being's future. And so, you know, I felt like there had to be a way to be who I am as a teacher and still be in the school system. So what I did is developed a way of laying out the standards and bringing all of what I do as an expression of those standards. And they are. And that's what's important, is that, you know, we can teach effectively. We don't have to give up ourselves in the public school system. In fact, I think it's very, very important, because there's this concept that learning is sitting still in a desk with a pencil and a paper, when we know all this research in the last 20 years of brain research, that that's not the most effective way to learn. You know, learning is a multi-sensory act, and the same at home. I always told my children, they went to public school and I homeschooled, because I was never satisfied with that. We would go, you know, every Saturday morning I would get my children up, we would go out to the Amish farm and get our fresh eggs. We would go to the local organic dairy and get our cheese and milk. You know, we did these things that they could experience life and process.
Yes.
So I feel like, yeah, school can be the same thing. We have to meet circumstance with powerful intention.
So how is the e-course structure then? What would you get, and what do you do?
Well, the e-course is structured, so first, the first thing I take people through is really getting to the heart of what is their intention in teaching. I think teaching is a soulful, passionate expression. Interestingly, I came to teaching out of parenting. I found my life's calling when I became a parent. I was like kind of a wispy in my, you know, creative spirit who didn't have much focus. And I had my first child, and it was like, bam, you know, this is where it's at for me. You know, I was like so taken by it. And you know, it was the first thing that ever called me deeply into research and studying and understanding something. Yeah. So, you know, it's like that I knew I had this deep purpose in my parenting, and I think the same thing goes for teaching. So I take people through really owning their soul in the act of teaching, just as I owned my soul in parenting. And then from there, looking at teaching over the year as a roadmap. You know, where is it that you want to go in the end? So you start at the end. Where do you want to arrive? What is it that you... Who are you in the matter of teaching? What are you taking these children? What are you committed to? Because if it's just about a bunch of facts and data, it's lifeless education. You
yes.
know, it's so
yeah.
so it really is. The biggest part of the course is getting people to the place where they own who they are and what they're committed to giving children. For me, it's I want to give children a passion for learning, that, you know, I want to ignite that fire so that, you know, if that's lit, we don't have to worry about how will it all turn out. You know, will they learn it? They will. And as a teacher, my son did not start reading until he was nearly third grade. The stuff I went through with the educational process and how they wanted to deal with him was disheartening, because I knew without a doubt he was very smart. He was not ready to sit down. You know, he leaped off ledges. He ran into walls. He was active, you know. He was
yeah.
not ready to sit down and learn. And yet, you know, we went through having to hold him back a year and all these things. And he ended up graduating at the top of his class. You know, he was smart. But, you know, that really changed how I looked at education, that we want children to be inside this everyone has to hit a standard. We're worse now. In America, it's getting worse. You know, all children have to reach this, or we're going to you know, withhold them from the next grade. Every child has to do this. When learning isn't linear like that, it's very complex. And so for me, I'm committed to the passion because that will carry through all of it.
Brilliant. That's brilliant because when you can inject that passion to more and more teachers, then everybody else can feel very empowered to change what they're doing, because it can feel as if you're up against the world. Like, why should I push against a system that's already pushing really hard? And even for homeschooling families that are working really hard too, this type of approach would be really good for them too.
Well, and I, you know, I really am a big fan of homeschooling because many times the educational system will not meet children where they're at, will not honor their learning process. You know, like my son, you know, it's like, it's why I began homeschooling at home, is because, you know, my son's needs were not going to be met by the educational system. And I knew who he was, you know, I knew who he was, and I wasn't going to allow the system to take that from him.
Oh, thank you for your inspiration. It's been delightful talking to you about storytelling and how we can be a lot more enthusiastic and excited about using stories with our children.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful. It's been absolutely a delight.
Today I've been talking to Sally Hoye, an early childhood educator and founder of fairydustteaching.blogspot.com. You can look for her on Facebook at Fairy Dust Teaching Blog. Thanks for sharing all these ideas once again, Sally. I'll be right back after this short break.
This is Courtney, Emily, and Esther from BabyChinoKids.com, a shopping portal for children's products and an international lifestyle blog. And you're listening to Raising Playful Tots.
Welcome back to the show. At the beginning, I mentioned the activity highlight of the week, which was magnetic letters on a cookie tray. I love how simple activities keep children engaged and active, especially when you can just see the same activity that you can do on so many different levels. So if you want to see that particular activity, nip on over to messforless.net and look for the post Fun with Magnet Letters and Cookie Tray for further inspiration. I hope you've had a really playful week. Have you been over to the blog recently? We have some new sponsors. Each week, all the links and the show notes are there. There's recommendations of books and blogs to follow as well. You can reach us there if you use the number of the show at the end of raisingplayfultots.com. So this show would be raisingplayfultots.com/102. It was lovely to hear from Jen TW, who listened to Bypassing the Grumps and Summer Bucket List. We connected on Twitter, and I was thinking, I don't know how many of you are actually over there on Twitter. I've connected with a couple of people recently, and her tweet really made me think, oh, I wonder who else is out there. So if you listen, please tweet me and say that you're listening so I can at least follow you. I'm at Play Activities. You've been listening to Raising Playful Tots, show number 102. Come over and play next week. Until then, find time for some unplugged play. Join with me each week as we share, learn, and laugh together about making the most of early childhood playtime. Goodbye!